this is Jen, and welcome to the latest episode of Minorities in Publishing podcast. You can find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com and on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. This is the first episode post Book Expo and Book Con, and it was just a kind of hectic time, but there was a good focus on diversity, and I was happy to meet various booksellers from other areas outside of New York City, in Michigan, in Georgia, who are people of color and really interested in finding out more about the books that are coming out and reaching out to a broad audience. So that was just really nice to meet them while standing in various lines. So this episode, I'm really excited to have and honored to have Andrea Davis Pinkney on. She is an award-winning and New York Times bestselling author, and she's an executive who served roles at several major publishing houses and focusing her expertise on children's literature, and she is currently a vice president / editorial director. So thank you so much, Andrea, for being on the podcast. One of my first questions is, I don't know if you used to be affiliated with CBC Diversity specifically, Andrea, but you were featured on their How I Got Into Publishing blog series, and they're still doing that series now. And you mentioned a frustration when you worked at Essence in trying to make book lists for Black parents and young readers, and that in being offered your first book publishing job, you saw a way to bridge that gap. So as an editor and a writer, do you still feel the need to make sure there are books for this specific audience, or do you find that there are more editors and publishers also trying to fulfill this need currently?
Well, first of all, Jen, let me say I'm so happy to be here with you. Thank you. And yes, I am a very active member of the Children's Book Council Diversity Initiative. And I encourage everyone who's listening, if you haven't already, go on CBC Diversity and look at all the wonderful blogging and initiatives that are going on at CBC. Yeah. So yes, I started my publishing career in magazines, and I was a senior editor at Essence Magazine. And ironically, that was the thing that led me to children's publishing. I was the senior contemporary living editor, and we had a whole lifestyle section of the magazine. And one of my roles was to create content that directed parents to children's books for African-American parents and families. And this was in the late 80s and early 90s. And as anyone in publishing will tell you, we love publicity. So if a magazine calls you up and says, send us books, we are right there. Yeah. We you know, every author, every publisher wants to get books in the magazine for that publicity. So when I was at Essence, I was calling publishers and saying, we're putting together a gift guide, a special section. Can you send me, you know, your top African-American titles, new debut authors, send me series, send me books for young readers, send me board books. And after I went through kind of the initial folks that were working in the genre, Walter Dean Myers, Patricia McKissick, Virginia Hamilton, you know, all wonderful books, then the dearth happened. Yeah. You know, we kind of just ran out. And I was saying, you know, I want, you know, the Black Babysitters Club. I want Sweet Valley High for African-American girls. I want board books for babies. And there was nothing. I couldn't fill the section of the magazine. And I'll never forget the day that my then boss, Susan Taylor, who was the editor-in-chief of Essence at the time, this was pre-email, sent me a memo. A memo arrived in my inbox from Susan, and it said, Andrea, remember your charge. And what she was referring to was, you have been charged to fill this section of the magazine. You know, remember your charge. And I thought, I have not forgotten my charge. I can't fill the section. Yeah. There's not enough content out there. And so I, you know, went home often feeling just discouraged. And I said to my husband, Brian Pinkney, who is a children's book illustrator, who was and still is very much in touch with his publishing colleagues as a creative talent creating content, I'd say, you know, you need to call your editor at these houses and tell them there needs to be a series for African-American girls. There needs to be more for boys. There needs to be fantasy. There needs to be board books. There needs to be books, picture book biographies. And as a magazine editor, one of the gifts that I've gotten from working in magazines is that your radar has to be up constantly. You have to fill that section of your magazine constantly. So you have to be thinking of ideas all the time. So I was saying to Brian, there should be this kind of series, and they should put this writer with this illustrator and make a book about fill in the blank. And poor Brian, I kept nagging him, call your editor, call this one, call the publisher. And finally, out of frustration, he just said to me one day, he said two things. He said, well, why don't you write the books? And he said, you know, all of these ideas that you're spinning off to me and you're telling me, call the publisher, he said, that is what a book editor does. You know, good book editors are the ones in-house concocting these ideas and thinking they should get this author with this illustrator to create this kind of book. He said, so you should consider becoming a book editor. And it was, since you talked about BEA, it was at a BEA many years ago. It was ABA then, American Booksellers Association. It's now Book Expo America now. So it was, he said, you should go to what is the equivalent now of BEA and walk around. And you yourself, Andrea, should go to the booth of these publishers and tell them what you're telling me. So I did. And one of the publishers was Simon & Schuster. And as fate would have it, at that BEA, Willa Perlman, who was then the president and publisher of Simon & Schuster Children's Division, I went up and I said, hi, I work at Essence Magazine, and here are some ideas for you. And Willa said, you know, she listened very thoughtfully, you know, and not only here are some ideas for you, but it was also a question like, why aren't these, why don't these books exist? To me, it was a no-brainer. It was such an obvious, you know, opportunity. And Willa said, why don't we have lunch? And we did. And, you know, we chatted, and I said, you know, with no agenda, really, but just to say, here are some ideas for you, you know, president and publisher of Simon & Schuster. And she offered me a job. She said, well, why don't you come and make the books, which is what my husband was saying to me. And so I had to really think about that. You know, I have such a kind of a magazine had come up, you know, through journalism school. I went to Syracuse University, and I had such a kind of a magazine orientation. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, this is an opportunity to make these books that don't exist. So that's kind of how it started for me. Kind of I left magazine publishing to enter book publishing, and I'm very glad that I did.
That's so interesting, because a lot of previous guests and people I know in the industry as well didn't even have that kind of background in terms of being introduced to publishing was something they learned about in college, that it was an actual feasible way to make money, especially if you're a lover of books. So were you already exposed to knowing that journalism, I mean, it is part of the publishing industry. So were you thinking that as a teen, as a kid, did you always know you wanted to be involved in magazines or something in print?
I always wanted to be something involved with words. And yeah, my secret dream as a teenager was to work at a woman's magazine. And I didn't know any magazine editors. I didn't really know any journalists growing up. I certainly didn't know, you know, a lot of career women. My mother was a teacher. And incidentally, you know, I think that a lot of that really influenced me because she was, you know, was and still is such a voracious reader. So there were books everywhere. And there was no genre for young adult or middle grade at that time. So I was reading adult fiction, Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, and the like. And I think even back then, I was thinking, there are women writing these books. There are people, and I would read the copyright page. Oh, Random House. Oh, you know, Simon Schuster. Oh, you know. So there's a company that makes these books. So I always kind of had that orientation, but ironically, it was the Mary Tyler Moore Show that influenced my career choices. Mary was a career woman. She was a television journalist. She lived in a big city, and she had her own apartment. And I thought, that's what I want to do. And I joke about it, but, you know, as a kid, I think that if I could have ripped off the front of the television and climbed onto the set of WJM and hung out with Mary Tyler Moore, I would have done it. And I thought, she's a journalist, I'll go to journalism school. So again, I went to Syracuse University, I majored in magazines, And that was the beginning for me, you know, and at a magazine, it is all about the story.
Yeah.
What are the stories that we're going to put, you know, into each issue? And, you know, it translates so well into what I do in book publishing because it's all about storytelling.
Yes.
Whether it's a magazine article or a book, it's about telling a good story.
Absolutely.
So that was the beginning.
So a common thread between you and previous guest, Tracy Sherrod, she's at Amistad, and she raved about you, by the way.
And I love Tracy.
She's so friendly.
Tracy, if you're listening, I'm sending out my girlfriend hello to you.
Yeah, she adores you. She just said, I love Andrea. And Tracy's so warm and kind.
She is.
She's so generous. And it seems that you both had mentorship in the industry, yet you also had this determination to really pursue it. You weren't giving up in terms of what you wanted to see these books happen. Tracy wanted to bring that voice also to the public. And you had your list of contacts from your magazine experience, which also helped to make your list grow when you became a children's book editor. So do you think that's part of that the balance and staying in the industry of finding the mentorship, but also finding that interior drive to keep going, even if it seems like you feel like the only one here, or you're not getting the support from above, but maybe you do have some one-on-one relationships or feel like you have your tribe to be able to keep going, that there's a need for both of those in order to stay in this industry?
I'm so glad you asked that. There is absolutely a need for it, especially now as we're, well, not now, but always. Mm-hmm. My primary purpose is to not only publish books across all genres for all people, but it really is to attract and recruit and retain people coming into publishing. Mm-hmm. So that said, I cannot say enough about mentorship. Mm-hmm. It is critical. And I say that as someone who has had amazing mentors in my career. Mm-hmm. I would not be having this conversation had it not been for those folks, men and women, not only in publishing, but across all sectors, mm-hmm. who have supported me over the years, kept me in the game. People I've picked up the phone and said, okay, here's what's going on. I need your help. I need your support. I need your guidance. It is absolutely key. So for people coming into the business, I say, find people who have what you want and ask them how they got it, mm-hmm. and stay in touch with them.
Yes.
And again, my mentors have been across all sectors, publishing, advertising, consumer products. And I've had many a moment where one of my mentors is a man. I've literally picked up the phone and said, do you have a minute? Can you meet me on the corner of 45th and 6th? Can we mm-hmm. walk around the block a few mm-hmm. times? Mm-hmm. Here's a situation. Can we talk it through? Mm-hmm. And I've gotten that guidance. Literally, my head, he's, you know, helped me kind of talk through a scenario, put my head back on, and go in and have the meeting or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think that's really, really key. And then in terms of the determination, you know, for anybody who's listening, I am only 5 feet tall, and I've been, as my husband lovingly likes to say, I'm a small person with a big mouth. Mm-hmm. And I think that has helped me and not helped me mm-hmm. In certain situations. So I think that the tendency is for, especially women, you know, for us to not be at the table, to not say what really matters. And I think that that's really key. And a mentor can help you do that. Mm-hmm. A mentor is someone who can say, all right, here's how you say it.
Yes.
Here's what the email should say.
Yes.
Here's when you go into that room, when you're at that table, here's the way to couch it, the way to spin it, the way to ask.
Yes.
So that at the end of the day, you can get to yes. And I think that's where the two come together. There are many passionate people that work in publishing. Mm-hmm. And I think that to, you know, especially as we're talking about diversity, as we, you know, build our lists and recruit people and retain people, I think it's important to get the language so that we can appropriately do what it is that we need to do and what we want to do.
Yeah, and that's a common thread in every interview. Is I've spoken to some people who felt that they never had that mentorship and they mm-hmm. didn't have support. It was a great guiding factor for them, especially when you start as an assistant. That is just such a hard role, and it's kind of like you're a boss, but you're definitely not a boss. But you have your hands in so many things as an assistant. And in talking to people trying to get into this industry, it's very disheartening to hear when there's that lack of support in any realm, in any area, that they're just not getting it. So thank you so much for your advice in terms of finding people.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen many young people throughout the years come and go. Mm-hmm. And it saddens me, especially when a diversity candidate leaves publishing. And I'll call the person and I'll say, what happened? You were doing great and this and that. And I'll hear of a scenario and I'll think, oh, like if only they'd called me, you know, yes. And not just me, you know, if they'd gotten that support, you know, and as they will describe a scenario or two, and I'll think, oh my gosh, if only someone had been there to say, okay, here's what you do.
Yes.
You know, that they would not have left publishing.
Yes.
So anyway, I encourage all this. And, you know, still today, you know, I've worked in publishing for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I still call people, like you mentioned Tracy Sherrod. Like, you know, my peers, my colleagues, those who've gone before me, I still call them.
Mm-hmm.
I still call them for advice.
Yes.
All the time.
Yeah. It's a constant learning process.
Of course.
Constant.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. It is. And I also want to put a plug in. This is kind of a good plug moment for CBC Diversity, Children's Book Council Diversity. We need diverse books. You know, we're kind of aligning our efforts now on internship programs,
yes.
Mentoring. Mm-hmm. The CBC has just created a packet now that is available for advice, you know, expert advice on when you have an internship and all that. So
yeah.
There's more resources becoming available.
Yeah, the mentorship program is very exciting for me, being in the industry, and I'm a substitute in case someone falls out. I'm a substitute mentor for the interns. And it was nice.
That's
one
great.
Of the descriptions was, you know, kind of like a therapist when
yeah.
necessary.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's true.
Of
it's
course.
Very true. I feel like sometimes you just need someone, like you said, to walk around with you and help you just see it from a different perspective and especially calm down or anything like that. Currently, I met Jason Lowe last week, actually, at Book Expo. He's the publisher of Lee & Lowe Books, and he's been putting out a call to publishers to conduct a survey of the ethnic background of their staff. And what's helped, especially in terms of getting people to really see the dearth of diversity in terms of books, are statistics. People don't always seem to believe you when you say they're not enough, because they'll kind of go to the go-to names, like the Walter Deans, the Toni Morrisons. So it's kind of the equivalent what Jason Lowe's asking of the Vita count and what CBCC has done. And CBCC, if for people don't know, they broke down the children's book by those who've written it based on ethnic background and also the content based on ethnic background and how that correlates or doesn't correlate. So do you think it's also essential to have this information in terms of the diversity in the industry, not just for books, which has been, I feel like, opening people's eyes, even though this information has been around for decades, but also to actually look within the industry and have that information as well?
Absolutely. I think that the data is key. I think that what Jason is doing is wonderful, because that informs what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so data is great.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. It's what we do with that information.
Yes.
That's the next step. That's the call to action. We have, you know, as a community, as a publishing community, right, it's important to say, here are the statistics, here are the facts, here's the hard data. And now we're going to take this and we're going to use it, you know, again, as our call to action to, you know, take the next right steps to change the data. You know, how does that, you know, my question is, how does that inform us for the actions that we're going to take? And I really applaud Jason for what he's doing.
Yes.
Because that information is critical. And you're right. You know, it's the numbers don't lie.
Yes.
And that's why we need them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's also interesting because, I mean, once the PW survey came out last year, I mean, that created a fervor online.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
It was a very small representative because it was of several thousand people asked, several hundred replied, and the numbers were horrible.
Mm-hmm.
1% African-American representation, 0.0 of all the other ethnic minorities specifically. And it did make, I mean, being in this industry, I was kind of always aware of it, but that did really kind of hit home, like, wow.
I know.
There really isn't. And it does kind of explain things
mm-hmm.
in various ways. And I do think there's this whole kind of circuitousness to the lack of diversity, that you can't just blame the authors and you can't just blame publishing.
That's
you can't
right.
just blame agents and distributors and booksellers.
That's right.
We all work together in this kind of topsy-turvy way to have books out there and mm-hmm. people creating those books as well.
Right. You know, it's I'm glad you raised that point, because there's an ecology to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very easy to say, well, you know, if there were more this, or if only that group did more of this,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't help us.
No.
It doesn't help us.
No.
We're all in this together. We each bring different strengths to the table. How can we inform the ecology
mm-hmm.
of what we do? And, you know, without publishers, the ecology gets messy. We need each other. We
yes.
need the unified front.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, without authors, none of us would be here.
Mm-hmm.
So we need the office. Without illustrators, you know, we need the publishers to create the books. So, you know, I think that that's part of the new day,
mm-hmm.
is that we, you know, let's stop pointing the finger.
Yes.
And let's just say we're all in this together, and we each bring different strengths and opportunities to it. And how can we do that?
Yes, absolutely. So your work as an author often reflects Black characters and experiences, whether in a historical context or completely fictional. So as an author, what motivates you to tell the stories you've told and the ones you're going to tell?
Well, it's interesting. I started by talking about my mom being she was an English teacher in eighth
mm-hmm.
grade. And again, I think that was just such a critical aspect of my life, you know, to be in middle school and to not have any or many books that were of the genre, because the genres didn't exist back then. And when I am creating a book as an author, I have several things going on. You know, I think, what is the story that I want to tell?
Mm-hmm.
And a good example of that is The Red Pencil, which is a novel, a recent novel that I wrote. And The Red Pencil is set in 2003 and 2004, when the Darfur genocide was beginning. And the way that kind of book began was that I thought, this is a story that's not being told.
Mm-hmm.
And again, my own two children, a son and a daughter, were in middle school at that time. And I said, you know, everybody's talking about Darfur and the crisis in Sudan. Do you know what's going on? And they kind of sort of knew about the war and
mm-hmm.
what was happening. And, you know, I travel a lot as an author. I go to schools all over the nation and all over the world. And, you know, I traveled. I visited schools in Africa. I visited schools, again, practically in every state in the United States. And I could see that, okay, A, young people didn't know what was happening in Darfur and Sudan. But also I thought, if any child is living through any tragedy, how do they make sense of that?
Mm.
How do we make sense of war? How do we make sense of tragedy? And I saw kids in many ways not being able to do it. And I thought, this is a story that I want to tell, and I want to help children contextualize any tragedy in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm with young people, that is kind of one of the inspirations of how I come to an idea. I've written a lot of picture book biographies, a lot of historical fiction, and books that have to do with real things that happen to real people that really happen. And, you know, at the time that I was beginning to write a lot of picture book biographies, that genre did not really exist. They weren't out there.
Hmm.
Again, that was back to my Essence days. I thought, there are not a lot of just great picture book biographies. One of my books, which is called Hand in Hand, 10 Black Men Who Changed America, is a compilation of 10 stories about notable black men, many of whom we've already read about,
mm-hmm.
But it was in a fifth grade classroom where someone said, Mrs. Pinckney, you know, I have to read a lot of books for school, and I'm sick of yucky spinach. I'm sick of books that, you know, I said, well, what kind of books do you like to read? You know, I like to read books about real people, but they're boring.
Mm-hmm.
They're not fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay. You know, my own child, you know, my own son said, you know, I'm sick of books that are just boring. And so I said, I'm on it. Thank you. Thank you, son. You know, so, and also in that kind of, around that time, you know, people were saying, I have to read a book about Barack Obama. I have to read a book about Martin Luther King. I have to read a book about Frederick Douglass. I have to read a book about Thurgood Marshall. I have to read a book about Jackie Robinson. And I don't want to run all over town getting different books. Can you put them in one book? So I did. Mm-hmm. And again, the goal there was to really make it fun and interesting mm-hmm. to read. And that's an example of mentorship as an author. I called Walter Dean Myers, mm-hmm. the late Walter Dean Myers. I said, can you help me? How should I do this? And he read that manuscript. He vetted it. He made some really great suggestions. And in the introduction of that book, I note visiting a program that comes out of the University of Chicago for young African-American males, where they refer to each other as brother authors. And the idea of that program, which is cited, which I write about in the introduction of Hand in Hand, is that these young African-American males are expressing themselves through books and reading and literacy and writing, and that's a vehicle that informs and changes them. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's why a book like this needs to exist. So in answer to your question, you know, many things inspire me, and I write for many reasons. Mm-hmm. And it's the inspiration often comes from young people themselves.
Oh, that's fantastic. So, and I think, I don't know if readers always know that. Especially mm-hmm. young readers, I wonder if they really do know that they inspire mm-hmm. a lot of the artists that they end up meeting.
Too. Absolutely. Yeah, and when I talk to young people, I'll often, again, be in a classroom, and I'll sitting in a chair, and I'll say, am I doing research right now? They'll say, no, you're just sitting here. And I'll kind of nod. I'll say, am I writing at this moment? And they kind of say, no, you're just sitting there. And I kind of get this kind of weird little look on my face. And then they see that, yes, just by being in your presence, mm-hmm. that you know, again, it's that magazine brain, you yes. know, that idea, the ideas are ticking. Mm-hmm. So it's why I love to visit schools, actually.
You're a major award-winning author as well.
Thank you.
Add that to the resume.
Thank you.
Jacqueline Woodson, she's noted the importance of awards, especially the Coretta Scott King, which you've won, and the Pura Belpre. And how do you feel that those kind of distinctions help to promote and celebrate excellence in writing, especially by and about ethnic diversity, especially if it seems that some of the other major literary awards aren't necessarily recognizing those works?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I want to give a shout out to Jacqueline Woodson. Speaking of award winning, and I think Jackie's probably won every major award in the field. And I will say for myself as an author, when I sit at that keyboard, I'm not thinking about that. Mm-hmm. I'm not thinking mm-hmm. about, that's not why we do what we do.
Yes.
So it's nice to be acknowledged, but it's not why we do what we do. Now, in answer to the question, it is critical that we have a Coretta Scott King Award, the Pura Belpre, for many reasons. And this is something that I wrote about in the Horn book years ago. There was a piece written about why we shouldn't have those awards. Mm. And I called up Roger Sutton at the Horn book, and I said, I would like to write why we should have the awards. Mm. I would like equal time. And mm. Roger was very gracious. He said, great. So that piece exists. So I encourage folks to just look at the point counterpoint of why the awards should exist. One of the main reasons is not, you know, of course, not only to shine a spotlight on talent and all the books that are out there, but to really present an opportunity for new talent mm-hmm. coming into the fold to get the attention that they might not otherwise get, to the point of your question. Mm-hmm. And that is why not only the Coretta Scott King, but the John Steptoe New Talent Award is mm-hmm. really, really critical. What I'm really enjoying now is that so many authors, and a perfect example at this moment is Kwame Alexander winning the Newbery Medal, mm-hmm. You know, for the most distinguished book for young people, given by the American Library Association. You know, also won with his book, The Crossover, which won the Newbery, you know, also won a Coretta Scott King honor. So we are seeing more talent, you know, a Kadir Nelson who's winning Callicott's and Callicott honors. We're seeing more of that, but it ain't over. That I don't, again, yeah. you know, to mm-hmm. your point about statistics, I don't want folks to say, well, we have a Black Newbery winner. That's great. You know, and there have been other Christopher Paul Curtis who, you know, really, I think, was the first to win both the Coretta Scott King Award and the Newbery Award for the same book in the same year, which was Bud Not Buddy. So again, there's work to be done, as Walter Dean Meyer said in his New York Times piece, you know, where are all the you know, people of color in children's books? It's yes, those awards definitely need to exist. They need to continue. And, you know, there's folks have accused those awards of segregating and you know, and all, and ghettoizing, and to that I say, you know, not true. We need those awards for all the reasons that we're discussing today.
Absolutely. And also, I have noticed, I've started counting, that we've had a couple each year, especially for writing for children, ethnic diverse authors. So, I mean, Jackie won this past year, unanimously voted for A Brown Girl Dreaming. And then Rita Williams Garcia has been nominated, Cynthia Cadahosa. So there is that recognition, but I don't think people realize also the importance of the Coretta Scott King, and that it's not just, oh, it's just something we made up to put a sticker, that it is rewarding excellence in literature as well. And that, I don't know how people don't always see that in bed. And I'm biased because I'm a person of color, so you know, I can't help but see that. But it does interest me how people see that there's this kind of bias, and whenever it's mentioned to say, well, this is for this group to reward excellence, or, you know, it's subjective, this business, but what we perceive to be excellence. And even Jackie had mentioned that people, when the Coretta Scott King had came about, people were like, well, no, you should open it up to everybody. And she said, let us have this. You know? Right. So that, yeah, it's just an interesting continuous discussion and argument. And now with the Walter coming out, yeah, I we've gotten those kind of rebuttals as well with the Walter. And if listeners don't know what the Walter is, there's going to be a Walter Award and a Walter Grant in honor of Walter Dean Myers, because he really, he was a huge inspiration to Ellen O, who co-founded We Need Diverse Books. And all of us, I mean, that New York Times piece is a part of history now, really. And people think, well, we believe in humans, and, you know, it's not fair that only specific groups will be awarded for published writers or emerging writers. So it's just, it's
we can still have the awards. I believe in humans. I love humans. I believe in humans. And I believe in the power and the importance of these awards. A good example is that recently, in recent years, the Horn Book has started to include the Coretta Scott King Award speeches in their awards issue.
Oh, okay.
Along with the Newbery speeches and the Caldecott speeches, the Coretta Scott King Award speeches appear. For years they didn't, and now they do. So that is a powerful statement. Thank you, Horn Book. Thank you for that. That's a powerful statement to say that these awards matter. If you go to the American Library Association, you know, annual meeting every summer where the awards are bestowed, you'll see that the Coretta Scott King Breakfast is one of the most attended. People say they come for that award ceremony to see, you know, the winners and hear the importance of it. And so, yes, so we got to just keep on keeping on. And, you know, with respect to the Walter, I think it's great. Again, you know, if you look comparatively over the years of these major awards, the men and women, the authors of color that are winning them, it's still not equitable, you know? And, you know, again, speaking as an author, someone who spends a lot of my time in classrooms throughout America, you see these classrooms are changing. These classrooms are changing. No, they are changed. You know, if you, you know, and I'm not talking about urban. You know, I'm in Kansas City, and I'm, you know, I'm in Ohio, and, you know, I'm in, you know, all of these many states, you know, Michigan, here, there, and everywhere, and in suburbs, and you'll see that the face of American classrooms is changing, And also, you know, those young people who are reading these books, they are the thought leaders and the influencers of tomorrow. Mm-hmm. They are the future authors, the future presidents, the future librarians, the future publishing executives, the future people that are making decisions about what goes on and is depicted on television. And, you know, with respect to the awards, they need to, you know, I always say, kids see what they see, and they don't see what they don't see. Yes. So if they don't see representation, if they don't see themselves in the books, if they don't see, you know, black faces, faces of color on book covers, they don't see it. Mm-hmm. So that's why these awards are important, because they've got to see it.
Yes.
Because they're making the decisions in the future. Long after all of us are gone, you know, they're going to be the one that say, you know, I read that Coretta Scott King award-winning book when I was in the seventh grade, mm-hmm. by a Jacqueline Woodson or a Kadir Nelson or a Christopher Paul Curtis. And that was my favorite book. Mm-hmm. Had that award not existed, they might not have, that they might, their attention might not have been directed to,
yeah.
it otherwise.
Yeah.
So
may I ask you to provide some advice? You kind of have already, in terms of mentorship and pursuing that determination. But for those starting to seek a career in publishing, like I said earlier, listeners have voiced some deep concerns about feeling unseen. And just, it's hard. I mean, it's hard. We're in a bad economic climate. Mm-hmm. Add that on top of feeling that you're switching careers and you're trying to take skills from one job to a new job and getting into an industry that is, I do kind of feel like it's a little saturated, especially in the editorial front, but that's because I'm from here and I speak to a lot of people who come to New York specifically to be in publishing and the arts in general. So do you have any, especially for diverse candidates, advice in terms of just kind of keeping up morale and just keep trying and mm-hmm. not take it personally? I think most importantly, I think it feels, rejection always feels personal.
It does, yeah. Yes. Yes, a couple things. One is that there is a belief, I find a lot of interns, young people, new people starting out, again, with the example I gave before, people leaving publishing, I'm like, oh, I wish they'd call me. There's the belief that they can't reach out to certain people. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm here to say, always reach out to me, no matter who you know, that there are people working in the business that would love to talk to you. And I find a lot of people say, well, I didn't want to call this one. I say, you know, call, she works in marketing, or he works in sales, or, mm-hmm. you know, this one, you know, and not, you know, you don't always necessarily have to reach out to a diversity candidate, you know, or someone in diversity working in the field. Just if someone can help you, reach out to that person. Mm-hmm. So there's that reluctance to reach out to people who've been working in the field for a long time. Yes. You can do that. The other thing is that we live in an age of social media. Thank God. That is an opportunity for you to, you know, young people, me, anybody, you know, to find like minds. It does feel lonely. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to deny that. When you are the only one in that conversation, in that room, and something happens, there's a discussion, a representation on a book cover, you're new, you're just starting out, you're an intern, you just got out of college, it's hard to be the one, I've been in that position, to raise your hand and say, you know what, that's not the best depiction. Mm-hmm. But if, with again, with the mentoring, you can pick up that phone and say, okay, here's what happened. I was in a meeting, there was an image on a cover, I didn't think it was... What should I do now? Mm-hmm. How could I have said it? Mm-hmm. What would be a way? Can I go to the person later? Can I, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And the guidance is there. There was something else I was going to say about this. There is the economic reality, mm-hmm. of working in publishing. It ain't the best paid field. And so there is that reality. I'm not going to deny it. So that is why, with the help of social media, networking, contacts, there are grants, there are opportunities that exist out there, but it's, again, having access to that information and, yes. knowing that, you know, and again, I'm not going to deny it, it's tough to stay in publishing when you feel that you see your friends over in other fields, advertising, television,
banking,
film, banking, mm-hmm. To say, wow, you know, we went to college at the same time. We have the same degree. They're making double or triple what I'm making. And here I am in publishing, you know, sitting in a meeting where I'm worried about how I'm going to pay my rent. And at the same time, I want to make a comment about that cover that doesn't look so okie dokie to me, you know. So, again, that is where, you know, opportunities, mentoring, guidance. We're out here, but we have to stick together and know who we are. And, you know, and also kind of finding out who is in the industry and who mm-hmm. you can go talk to.
Yes.
I think is important.
Yeah.
I think it's really key.
Yeah. And be polite, I want to emphasize again. Because I feel at times, and I express this with Tracy and others, that there's a kind of expectation sometimes of, oh, I'm black, you're black, you should help me. Mm-hmm. But if there's an aggressiveness to that mm-hmm. or just a disrespectful manner, mm-hmm. that just doesn't sit well with anybody.
I agree.
You know? And I agree with what you say. You don't necessarily have to go to specific people to, you know, get that mentorship, get that guidance. Because I know one of my bosses who was a great mentor to me, and I credit her with just helping me grow in this industry. And mm-hmm. we were both around the same age, and mm-hmm. you know, but kept the professionalism going, but there was a friendliness to it. But she was the first boss ever to push me for a promotion without me having to, you know, make a PowerPoint presentation and do all this kind of rigmarole to say, well, see what I did in 2004 is, then that carries over to 2005. Mm-hmm. So it is important to find those relationships. And sometimes they can come from very unexpected places.
It's very true. Yeah. And I think it's important to remember, too, it's not only what you say, it's how you say it.
Mm, absolutely.
And that's where the mentoring is key. That's where the grooming is key. That's where the professionalism is so important. Because demeanor goes a long way.
Absolutely.
I meet many skilled people, and I say this to interns. I say, basically, you've gone to college, you have basic intelligence. You can gather information, you can write flap copy, you can help me once I, you know, perhaps train you on creating a profit and loss mm-hmm. document for me. If you've gone to college, or even if you're not, if you have a certain level of intelligence, you can learn things. Mm-hmm. That's one piece of it. To your point, demeanor, delivery, professionalism, that's a big part of it. Because, right, if I'm going to recommend you for a promotion or a job, or I have a job in the back of my mind, or I know who's just left a department or who's about to leave, mm-hmm. you know, I may think, that person's really smart, they have basic intelligence, but you know what? She was a little, she was a little too aggressive in that meeting or whatever. So I wouldn't yes. recommend her. But the flip of that is, to your point, if I think, you know what, she's got all the right stuff. Or let's say she or he doesn't have that background or that information or that experience. I think, well, they haven't learned this, but you know what? She's professional. She shows up on time. Her demeanor is great. I'm putting her name in that ring. Mm, yeah. Yes. In fact, that happened to me recently where someone, and also, just part of this, stay in touch with people.
Yes.
Let them know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Even if you love your job. You know, I shoot them an email. I just wanted you to know this project that I worked on got picked up by blah, blah. Or, you know, any little bit of good news. Just keep it out there. You know, yes. I mean, not in a, you know, conceited
email,
way.
Email blast, newsletter yeah. kind of way.
Yeah, you don't have to be like that. But, you know, mm-hmm. right. Just let folks know. And I tell that to people, too. I say, look, I don't have a job for you right now, if there's somebody that I'm impressed with. Mm-hmm. I say, but every now and then, shoot me a note. Let me know of a project that you're working on, mm-hmm. if there's updates to your resume, something you're really proud of. And, you know, again, for me, it's that magazine brain, that radar is always up. Mm-hmm. And it's like finding an apartment. You know, I'm always waiting for the opening.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think,
yes.
okay, she would be really good for that.
Yes.
You know, so that's really important.
Thank yeah. you, Andrea, so
oh,
much
thank you.
For your time. So how may people be able to connect with you on social media?
Well, please get in touch with me on social media. On Twitter, you can find me at Andrea Davis Pink. I'm on Facebook under my name, Andrea Davis Pinkney, and I have a website, which is AndreaDavisPinkney.com. And I look forward to hearing from you.
Yeah. Thank you again for your time, Andrea.
Thank
I
you.
I really appreciate your insight.
Thank
and
you.
Your thoughts and just being very candid about your experiences. And yeah, it's just really helpful for, I think, just it's simply something people need to hear from people in the industry and to know that it's possible. You know, there's know-how, there's, you know, follow-through. So I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Really. Thank you for being here with me today. And as I said, you know, to your point, we're all in this together. So I look forward to continuing the dialogue.
So next episode, we're going to have Ashley Ford, formerly of BuzzFeed, to talk with us. And yeah, already scheduling stuff for July, and the podcast is going to be a year in August, which is, years go fast.
Wow, congratulations. That's amazing.
So I'll have to make more buttons, obviously. So thank you again, Andrea.
Thank you.
Everybody will be back in a couple weeks.